Good afternoon. Hope everyone had a great break. The Cabinet held its first meeting of the year today, and in addition to covering off a number of specific papers, we had a good discussion about the year ahead, as you would expect. Building a strong, growing economy will remain our number one priority for 2016. That's important in a world full of risks, particularly in China. As we've seen recently. The first few weeks of New Year have already reminded us how concerns about those international risks can ripple through the world's financial markets. So here in New Zealand, we have to focus on the things we can control, such as our own competitiveness and economic performance, so we are well placed to meet external challenges. But we shouldn't forget that New Zealand is performing very well compared to most other countries. Our tourism and service sectors are growing, as is construction, manufacturing, ICT, and a number of our primary industries. Over the next year, we'll continue to roll out clear and sensible government policies so businesses have the confidence to invest, create new jobs, and pay higher wages. We'll continue to focus on improving the competitiveness of our economy in a way that provides security for Kiwi families. We'll continue to keep a tight leash on spending to take pressure off interest rates and inflation. We'll continue to demand better results from the tens of billions of dollars taxpayers spend each year on public services. We'll continue to invest in modern infrastructure like schools, hospitals, roads and broadband. And we'll continue to seek new opportunities to give our exporters greater access to international markets through trade agreements such as TPP. Housing affordability remains a big focus. There's a busy pipeline of consents and development underway in Auckland, and we need to ensure that that translates into more houses on the ground sooner. That includes passing the RMA reforms. Tomorrow I'll give my first speech of the year in Auckland. As New Zealand's largest city, our biggest commercial centre, and the main gateway for international tourists, we all need Auckland to succeed. The government is backing Auckland by investing billions of dollars in infrastructure needed to support its growth. Tomorrow I'll provide an update on some of those key projects and a highlight on some of the government's priorities for the year ahead. As you're aware, next month we're hosting the signing of the TPP agreement in Auckland. And the Trans-Pacific Partnership is our largest free trade deal and has been 25 years in the making. It'll give us much better access to more than 800 million consumers in 11 countries across Asia and the Pacific. The net overall benefit to New Zealand is estimated to be at least $2.7 billion by 2030. There's more jobs, higher incomes and a better standard of living for New Zealanders. As a country, we won't get rich selling things to ourselves. Indeed, we need to sell more of our products and services to customers around the world, and TPP is a catalyst for ensuring that that happens. In terms of my own activity this week, I'm in Auckland tomorrow, Wednesday, Wellington on Thursday, and back in Auckland on Friday. Sorry about the time, but I'm a little bit posh today, so I probably can't be out here by 4:30.
The national interest analysis that you released today, are you on the back foot here? You've lost the argument with the TPP critics. Is there a response to that?
Oh, I think we're winning the argument actually with the New Zealand public, who have seen for a long period of time that asking New Zealand businesses to compete with one hand tied behind their back in the biggest economy in the world, the United States, and the third largest like Japan, puts us in a disadvantaged position. I think there's been a lot of misinformation about TPP. We released a fair bit when we first announced the deal. We released the text, and the national interest analysis is just another step in that. So there's nothing new about that.
That report clearly says that some of the obligations, non-legal obligations, could restrict government's ability to control their domestic politics.
We've always had talked about the fact that there would be safeguards. There are safeguards around what's called an investor-state dispute resolution. Again, there's nothing new. That's been in quite a number of free trade agreements. Actually, those investor-state provisions are there really to protect New Zealand companies. It's not our expectation that the New Zealand government would be sued. We certainly haven't been in the past. And actually, the way we operate means, in my opinion, it's very unlikely we would be in the future. And the safeguards already carve out things that people might be concerned around, like public health in relation to smoking. So, it's a national interest analysis that runs for 270 pages, so it's duty bound to say, you know, those provisions are there, but those provisions are very much about protecting New Zealand investors in offshore markets where they might have less confidence about the actions of the government.
Say, for example, a New Zealand SOE wanted to invest overseas, and the government of the day, in 10 years' time, decided it wanted to subsidise that. SOE. This report says it might not be able to do that.
Well, there are always hypothetical examples, but I mean, the point of a free trade agreement is to remove inefficiencies, if you like, and things that would bias, you know, what you ultimately do. But investor state, if you think about it, firstly, we've had those provisions there for a long time. There's never been a case taken against New Zealand. And in fact, the threshold for investor state is extremely high. And you saw that when there was an attempt to take a case against Australia in relationship to tobacco. So you can always create hypothetical examples, but the biggest risks are not against New Zealand government or our capacity to make laws. But by far the biggest risk is New Zealand companies investing overseas and not enjoying the sort of, you know, professionalism, if you like, and consistency which occurs in New Zealand.
Are you worried that the US Congress will never pass it again?
Well, I can't speak for the US Congress. I wish I could, but I can't. But in my view, the United States will actually sign up to TPP. Their lawmakers will. They're obviously coming to New Zealand on the 4th of February for the signing ceremony. And the reason they'll do it is because actually the US is going to be a net beneficiary from TPP. Notwithstanding it's the largest economy in the world, it will give it much greater access, not only just to Japan and the other countries for which it's trying to sell its goods and services, but also TPP is a foundation block for a regional trading agreement. There are 21 countries and economies in APEC, and in my opinion, over time, more of those countries will join. So this is a starting point from which I think you'll see more participants over time, and that's an even bigger prize for the United States. So I'll be pretty sure they'll sign up over time.
If a future Labor government wanted to stop house sales to foreigners, would TPP stop them?
Well, you have to go and ask that themselves. I mean, in the end, when you sign up to these, it's a document that you agree to, and if you want to break the provisions of that, then there'll be a, you know, bundle of lawyers that will be able to give you a view of what that might all mean. But ultimately, it's a breach of good faith. In the same way that, you know, when another counterparty country like Canada, if it agrees to the terms and then doesn't honour them, then I don't have the legal answer on how you can sort of test that.
But are you saying that the TPP says that they shouldn't, or they're not able to, there's no provision code, but you don't know what the legal consequences would be?
Well, you'd have to go and get specific legal advice of what they can or can't do as a result of it. I mean, if you don't honour it, you're not meeting your obligations, and that's not the way we operate. But I can't tell you exactly what would ultimately happen. I mean, what a country could do. It's like, you know, under other free trade agreements, if you don't honour your provisions, you can get taken off to the WTO, and that's what happened, for instance, with apples, when we believed it was in breach of CR, and then there was a long-standing case, and we tested our rights through in the WTO, and we ultimately won. And when we did win, Australia, in the end, had honoured the ruling of the WTO. So there'll be a legal process, but I can't answer that, please.
From just looking at your speech tomorrow, the government look at bringing forward the funding for the
Well, I'm not going to rule out what's in and out tomorrow because you've only got one sleep to wait for the speech, but it's a speech that looks very heavily at infrastructure projects, not just in Auckland, but it does look at those issues and gives the government's perspective and next steps, if you like. But in terms of the specifics, you've got to wait till tomorrow.
If the government did bring forward that railway spending, would that be the get the electricity rail going, or is it more that you want more infrastructure to get in Auckland to help the economy?
We are spending billions and billions of dollars as a government on infrastructure, so the announcements we make tomorrow will ultimately mean that the government increases even further its expenditure in infrastructure. We're doing that because that infrastructure underpins the efficiency and competitiveness of our economy. We're not doing it because we think we need to stimulate the economy per se. If you think about what's happening in Auckland, for instance, the construction sector is very busy in Auckland with the residential and commercial rebuild. So I don't think we need to be doing it to stimulate jobs in Auckland, but we certainly need better infrastructure, not just in Auckland, around the rest of New Zealand. And that's been the build out of everything from ultra-fast broadband to, you know, roading and rail projects that we've done around the country.
And will we see other announcements tomorrow around, you spoke earlier about housing affordability and, you know, getting out to the quicker in Auckland? will be announcements along those lines tomorrow?
The speech touches on housing affordability. It's a bit more probably I describe as a summary of where we think we're at and what some other steps might be, but it's not a group of specific initiatives. I wouldn't be looking at something, you know, hard and fast that's going to say this is definitely going to work. Our general perspective on what's happening in housing is that we're now starting to see, you know, a consensus view. I think that supply is the issue. I think you are going to see, in my opinion, even more construction taking place, and you've seen a lot occurring over the last few years. And in fact, actually, despite what the demographic survey said yesterday, I mean, if you look at what the Minister of Housing was saying today, he's making quite rightly the point that interest rates are much lower and affordability's actually got a lot better on if you look at the overall package for people. But we are saying we need to build more houses faster. It is our expectation that the demand in Auckland is going to continue, that the growth in the Auckland population is going to continue, and we just need to build a lot of houses between now and the next sort of 5 to 10 years. So we need to make that process as smooth as possible.
Is there an initiative tomorrow that will help that, or is it more just pulling on and pushing the things that you're already doing?
Well, there are always things that might be able to help, but the basic theme of the speech is not housing affordability.
So, how concerned are you about the spread of the Zika virus, given it's already spread in
Samoa? We're obviously suggesting that people are cautious. And not that they avoid travel. I mean, if you look at the travel advisory, as quite rightly pointed out, it's been reported in Samoa, potentially in other parts of the Pacific as well. So it's certainly saying people, you know, don't necessarily stop travelling, but if you're a pregnant female, then you should just be cautious about exposure to mosquitoes. We don't think the risks are, you know, really, really large risk, and we wouldn't say to people that they shouldn't travel, but they should just be cautious.
The Ministry of Health, why is it not providing more updated information about the last update that they provided in 4 days ago, and it's gained a lot of momentum?
Well, I think it's gained a bit more exposure. I mean, I've had a couple of notes sent up to me over the Christmas break about it. It sits in the category, as I said earlier. I think people have been aware of it, but I think it sits within that category of people being cautious. It's very much like dengue fever and the likes, you know, and so much that, you know, we recognise that there are health implications of it, but we don't tell people that they shouldn't travel to a place simply because it's there. They just need to be cautious around their exposure to mosquitoes.
And what action is being taken by these monitoring?
Well, I think they just simply, there's testing going on about whether the symptoms or signs are being shown, and what we know is that in Samoa and other places that has been the case. And obviously we're just monitoring, you know, in terms of, you know, making sure our travel advisory, I think, reflects where we see Zika virus, you know, prevalent.
The Greens are proposing an independent policy for streaming within the Treasury for the political parties. What do you think of that idea?
Like two other Greens are worried about the costing of their own projects and Labor's, because obviously usually pretty large. But I don't publicly, you know, personally think it's a terribly good idea. Firstly, I don't think it would cost $1 to $2 million. Secondly, I don't think it would actually achieve what they're saying, which is I think they'd either just ignore it if they didn't like the numbers, and it would be quite static. Because in the end, for instance, a lot of times the Greens and Labor just want to raise taxes, and all they'll simply do is say, this is what the analysis of that shows, which is it brings in a certain amount of revenue. They'll totally discount the Treasury perspective, which will be that raising taxes reduces activity and therefore overall has significant implications for your economy. So, you know, having someone with access to a model isn't going to do a hell of a lot, and $1 to $2 million realistically is, you know, two or three analysts. I mean, political parties have their leaders' budgets, they can use them. I accept that they're smaller for the Greens than they are for Labor, but you know, let's see, it is a massively important initiative.
So they've asked for cross-party support on this, you're saying no?
Well, I don't see it as the biggest initiative that's required.
Cabinet is in a privileged position, though, by virtue of the fact that the government's been actually presented policies prompted by Treasury, and they have their own.
Yeah, but I mean, that's also true that, you know, political parties have their own funding mechanisms, they have leaders' budgets. I mean, didn't stop the Greens and others running off to, I think ZNZIR or Bill, or I think Bill actually to cost some of their, you know, their initiatives. I mean, look, there are other countries in the world that do have these units. It doesn't take the politics out of those debates. So if that's the argument, then it won't reduce the politics, they'll just simply ignore the bits they don't like. I mean, when Labor was in government, as you quite rightly pointed out, they had the Treasury go out and cost the student loan policies, and then said that A, wouldn't police them, B, basically ignored them, C, they were totally wrong, D, they cost a lot more than what they said. It doesn't actually solve the political issues.
Prime Minister, just looking ahead to Waitangi, and after we wide, sort of, we had to call for February the 2nd, you know, Kingi Tauru and Waihara Wera to decide whether or not you'll be allowed onto the lot on the ride.
Right.
You know, will you, you know, are you expecting to be blocked from that ride? Will you try and, you know, you'll be looking for these people about whether you're going to be allowed on or not, or are you just intending to go?
Well, I'm intending to go. Unless they don't want me to go. So, you know, in the end, I'm not going to gate crash the Lower Marae. But every year, there's always been a call for me not to be able to go, or some sort of protest. I mean, whether it was the mixed ownership model, whether it was mining, there's been a series of different issues about which, you know, Kingi and others have had a view. But I turn up to Waitangi because I made that commitment when I was leader of the opposition that I would go there and engage in a debate. Now, if they want to have a debate about TPP, I'm more than happy to do that, and actually I really actively encourage them to listen, because actually we can probably allay them of great many fears they've got. But I'm not going to gate crash the place. In the end, if the governing body of the Marae say they don't want me there, then I won't be there. But that's, I think, a much broader issue than just one person expressing a personal view.
Are you worried about a large protest when the trade ministers come to Auckland? Are you worried about it deciding?
Well, I think there will be a protest, but there's been a group of people that are just opposed to TPP long before they saw the text, long before they saw the national interest analysis. They're just fundamentally opposed, but these people are opposed to free trade deals. But I don't see any protests in New Zealand to rip up any free trade deal that we've signed. Why? Because they're in New Zealand's interest to do this. This is a free trade deal that gives us access to 800 million middle income consumers. Its economic benefits are about 2.5 times the size of the Chinese FTA. Successive governments have been trying to conclude this deal, and actually it's great for New Zealand. And as I said at Ratna earlier in the week, I mean, if we don't sell our products to those consumers, then Australia will fill the gap for us, because they sell many of the products that are at the heart of TPP, including our agricultural ones. So it's inconceivable that New Zealand would not be part of TPP. And that's why Andrew Little can't answer the most basic question he gets asked, like, will you support it or won't you? I mean, he was floundering around on Radio New Zealand this morning like it was the first time someone's ever asked it. It's not a very hard question. If he went to Ratna and banned TPP, if he really believes what he said, he should have had the courage of his convictions to say he's not going to support it.
Are you putting any extra security provisions in place for
I never talk about my security, but my people always look at it and deal with the appropriate issues. But the fact that there could be a protest at the Lower Marae in Waitangi is not breaking news. Every single year I've been there, there have been protests from people shouting me down, yelling and screaming, jostling, throwing things at me. You know, you've been alongside me most of the way, witnessing it. It's just going to be another day at Waitangi in the Lower Marae. It won't be any different this year to previous years. The topical change, the animosity from certain group of protesters will not.
Do you not think it's legitimate for Labor and New Zealand to oppose the sovereignty issues of the TPP but support the lowering of tariffs?
Well, if that's the case, why did they have an investor state dispute in the China FTA? Why is it okay in the China FTA but not okay in TPP? I mean, they know that there's nothing to fear here, and it's there for the protection of New Zealand companies investing abroad. There's never been a case taken against New Zealand, in my personal opinion, and never will be one. But we have a very clean system of government, we have an independent judiciary, and we act in a transparent way. Without those provisions, there are potentially some risks for our people. But, you know, that's the simple point, isn't it? If it's good enough for the China FTA, then surely it must be good enough for one with the United States of America.
Just quickly on the flag, you've got the pile Lockwood and your lapel there. A good chance we can see it behind you there, out front of Parliament, anywhere around here before the referendum?
No, actually, I haven't sort of considered those points. mean, I'd like to see it flying, only simply because I think, yeah, we're going to go through the referendum process now between the 4th and 24th of March. I think it's one of those things where people get to see it a bit more, the familiarity helps them, you know, I think solidify their view about whether they want to change or not, so it's a good thing for people to see it, but in the end we'll see how it goes.
Is there any rules inside
the
cabinet
account? Well, I don't know. Yeah, I'd have to get advice from the cabinet office on that.
Australians seem to be pushing for free highs and the Zealand to be on the $5
bank. Yeah, I saw that.
Do you have an issue with
that? Well, I've given a long list of New Zealanders that should be on Australian notes because they're great Australasians, but he's not a lot, he's the Kiwi.
Well, so what did you make of the mass executions carried out by Saudi Arabia at the start of the
week? We were deeply concerned by that. Firstly, because we don't support the death penalty under any circumstances. Secondly, because we think it heightened the tensions in the region, particularly with Iran.
Will the government still go ahead with its plan to give them ultimately the last of Saudi government this year, given its executions?
We don't have any plans to change what we're doing in the area. It's not to the Saudi government per se, of course, so it's actually an investor, and it's the establishment of a agricultural hub in Saudi Arabia, because we do believe that has benefits for the wider agricultural sector, but it's not specifically the Saudi government per se.
Yeah, well, the MPEP papers say that Saudi Arabia owns all the government basically controls all the abattoirs, so it will be gifted.
Well, I'd have to go and check all the details of my understanding. It's been established actually on the farm that Al Khalif owns, but I'd have to go and check that. No, I might be wrong. Okay, thanks much.